Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence on all kinds of matters, specifically in the economic warfare space, but much more generally, that we prize here with respect to this free world of ours and the threats to it, is our first guest. He is Kevin Freeman, the author of two terrific books on the subject, Game Plan and Secret Weapon. He is also the contributing force behind globaleconomicwarfare.com, a senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy, and the poobah uber alles of new programming coming out of his efforts at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, it is so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Especially important to be able to do so, to get your quick response, Kevin, to what went down in Singapore over the overnight hours here in the United States. I'm sure you've had a chance to see some of, if not all of, the president's remarks after his meeting with Kim Jong-un yesterday, our time. Tell us what you made of the upshot of their announcement.
Well, the first thing is it's obvious that President Trump is a disruptive force in politics around the globe, not just here. And his approach, which is not the traditional approach, but it uses a lot of the weapons that we talk about, is it both the economic carrot and the stick. And he appears to have had some positive success. And I think that that we'll see changes in North Korea, and I think that could be very good for the world.
Well, it could be, and I'm hopeful. There are, however, certain considerations that are operating. The president seems to be signaling that he's prepared to take a patient approach to this denuclearization of the North Korean regime, believing that it'll get started quite quickly, but that it will take some time, and there's a point of essentially no return that will be achieved fairly quickly. Do you anticipate, Kevin Freeman, that some of the economic assistance that he has indicated would be forthcoming from the South Koreans, from the Japanese, even from the United States, might begin to flow even before we're very far in that trajectory?
Well, I think it's possible, and obviously these are treacherous waters, and you have to tread carefully. But I don't expect a Ritz-Carlton to pop up overnight.
Condos at the seashore, that sort of thing.
Exactly. No, I don't think we'll see those immediately. But I think those are part of the carrot that's been dangled out there. We're not going to see Singapore appear in North Korea instantaneously. It will take time. But, you know, a combination of you can go continue to extreme poverty and misery economically, or you can move to a part of an advanced nation. I think that's a good combination. The Chinese have not provided that except for the extreme ruling elite.
And Kevin, you're a student of geopolitics as well as economic warfare. Are you troubled by the prospect that the United States would suspend its military exercises with South Korea, at least as the president put it, unless it turns out the negotiations aren't going as they should, on the grounds that, as he put it, which sounded awfully familiar, given the kind of criticism we've heard from the North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians over the years, that these exercises are provocative against the North.
Yes, because I know that the intent behind the exercise is a defensive one. It's not a threatening one. You know, you have to keep the threat in place. And so I believe that you maintain the ability as long as you can, and you don't pull back from them. The idea of suspending them may be a little premature. I don't know. None of us were in those meetings. That's certainly what the Chinese are insistent upon for anything to go forward. But that's one that I'd be concerned about, because that is our biggest stick.
Well, and it is a reversible one as long as the forces remain there and our will to reestablish those exercises is maintained. The trouble, as I see it, is that you have perhaps had a statement made by the president that will make that difficult to undo. And more to the point, you've got the South Korean regime, which would, I think, love to throw those things over the side permanently, now in a position to presumably object to our continuing them. We'll watch that closely, as will you, Kevin Freeman, at globaleconomicwarfare.com and the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. And finally, Kevin, speaking of China, there is a report that in addition to now three different individuals who have been apprehended or are being prosecuted for espionage on behalf of Communist China, there's yet another instance of the Chinese penetrating and extracting apparently very sensitive information from a U.S. Navy contractor, specifically that would give them insights into anti-ship warfare techniques that we've been developing, among them hypersonic missile technologies that would be useful for that. Give us a sense, Kevin, of how this fits into a larger pattern, which I suppose is what's really problematic, but what this particular incident might portend as well.
First off, let's recognize they hacked into a contractor. This is highly sensitive classified information that they stole from a contractor. And the law as it reads, that becomes a criminal act, essentially. It's corporate espionage. If they'd hacked the same information directly from the Pentagon, we could have deemed it potentially an act of war. And so it's our systems are behind times because contractors are so essential to the way that we produce weapons, the way that we operate the military, and so forth. And so I was actually having a conversation over the weekend with a Lockheed Martin executive on this very subject. He's concerned about, in Fort Worth, he looks around the corporate campus and sees the security, and he says, you know, a very sophisticated group like the Chinese could come in and steal information. And that's, in fact, what happened here. Hundreds of gigabytes of data information that's very sensitive and very important to our military, taken straight from a contractor.
And it seems as though the contractor had it on an unclassified software system or database. I mean, it just boggles the mind that we'd make it that easy for them to steal it. And Kevin, lastly, I think what's so troubling about this, of course, are the cost avoidances that these sorts of ripoffs of our technology provide the Chinese. Speak to that, if you would, quickly.
Well, if you can steal it, you don't have to develop it. And the ability for the Chinese to access this type of secret information and just take it in basically broad daylight, like you said, from an unclassified system, it saves them enormously and costs us enormously. We've spent huge amounts of money to get there, and they take it in a second.
Yeah, and they may well be able to field it far more quickly than we are ourselves. Kevin, so much more to talk about. We're out of time for today, though. Thank you for the great work that you do for us at the Center for Security Policy as our senior fellow specializing in economic warfare, as well as in your out there outlets, notably Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman and globaleconomicwarfare.com. Next up, we will speak with Paul Prentice of the Centennial Institute, an economist, more on this U.S.-China relationship, trade and otherwise. That and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Attention on deck. We have the Commander-in-Chief, United States Navy Pacific Fleet, now retired Admiral James Ace Lyons, in the house, or virtually so in any event. He is a regular featured guest of Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very proud to say, as well as the Military Committee Chairman for the Center for Security Policy. He's a distinguished naval officer with some 36 years of service to his country, rising through the ranks from able-bodied seaman to a four-star Navy admiral. We spoke of him in quite florid detail with former Secretary of the Navy John Layman yesterday in our very special interview with him about his new book, Ocean's Ventured, in which Admiral Lyons features prominently. And who better to talk with, having commanded the U.S. Pacific Fleet with great distinction, than Admiral Lyons, about what has gone down just in the past few hours in Singapore, in the conversation we touched on with Kevin Freeman a moment ago, between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, the chairman of North Korea's party. Admiral Lyons, I don't even know where to begin. What did you make of it all?
Well, you know, as I've said in a number of op-eds and the most recent one, make no mistake, Kim Jong-un might be sitting at the table, but actually President Trump is negotiating with China. And I don't see anything that has changed my view of that situation. This is a touchy-feely agreeing session right now. But to me, specific steps must be taken by North Korea to put any substance into this declaration that they are willing to denuclearize, which I look at most skeptically. The first thing, in my view, that has to happen is that inspectors from the International Nuclear Energy Agency need to be allowed to go into North Korea and inspect that site, their test site that they said they destroyed, and ensure that it has been destroyed, and to see if there are other hidden test sites. And the next positive thing that I would see as totally necessary to indicate any substance to these negotiations is the removal of the TELs. These are the transporter erector launches that give North Korea the mobility and the flexibility to be able to launch an attack against us in 30 minutes. And without those TELs, it would take them over 2 hours, which would give us time to destroy them before they ever launch. Now, who supplied those TELs? China. They were made in China. China had to know the specific dimensions of the intercontinental ballistic missiles to construct those TELs. These are 16-wheel TELs.
So I take it you don't credit, Admiral Lyons, the Chinese explanation that they thought they were just going to be used for hauling lumber.
Pure nonsense, Frank.
I thought you might be more colorful than that, but thank you for toning it down for radio, sir. Let me ask you about this, Admiral, because, again, I'm so pleased that you pointed this out, because it removes, it seems to me, from even the idea of a debate that China is up to its eyeballs in creating the threat that North Korea poses to us. And so the question occurs, how is it that successive U.S. administrations, going back at least to the day of Bill Clinton, have indulged in this idea that the Chinese are natural allies in trying to contain this problem, must be made a key part in the negotiations? You say they're at the table. Well, they literally were running the table in the past, and that they must be placated in terms of political concessions or other benefits in order to induce them to support our efforts.
Yeah, well, let's face it. There'd be no nuclear weapon issue in North Korea without China. It was China that provided them the wherewithal to be in the position they are today. They certainly would not have such an advanced program without China's assistance. And your listeners should never forget that North Korea is the offsite laboratory for Iran. So whatever North Korea has, you can put money in the bank. Iran also has it, which when translated, that means Iran does have a nuclear weapon capability today.
Admiral, you have laid out several steps that are tangible signs of good faith in actually denuclearizing, as the president has said, completely verifiably and irreversibly. Now, he has indicated that that's what President Kim Jong-un has promised to do. It isn't in the document, as best I can tell, but it certainly is the case that the president agreed to make some tangible adjustments on our side. And as a former naval leader, I did want to ask you about this decision by the president, his pronouncement that he considered, as do the Chinese, as do the Russians, as well as the North Koreans, our military exercises with South Korea to be, quote, provocative, unquote, and that he's suspending them temporarily, mind you, but nonetheless, he's suspending them. Tell us what the implications are of that for the readiness of our forces and their deterrent credibility, as you see it, sir, and also to the extent to which we will find it difficult, if not insuperably hard, to resuscitate those, given the character of the South Korean regime at the moment, which doesn't much like these things, should the need be deemed to arise because the negotiations aren't going well, the condition that the president laid out.
Well, I'm surprised that the master of the deal gave such a significant tip of the hat to North Korea and China by suspending those operations. Certainly, it affects our readiness. It affects the readiness of the South Korean forces. And all this propaganda that these are provocative exercises bent on plans to invade North Korea are pure hogwash. They are nothing but defensive operations because of the advanced offensive position taken by North Korea. I would have much preferred that the president demanded that North Korea withdraw their thousands of artillery pieces that are on the DMZ, specifically aimed at the capital of South Korea. And that, would to me, should have been the starting point. The same way, you know, it's China's objective, their key objective, is to get us removed from the Korean Peninsula. Keep that in mind. Everything they do is focused on that objective.
Yeah. Do you think that there is some movement in that direction as a result of these conversations between the president and Kim Jong-un?
Well, I don't know at this point, but certainly I would not have suspended those exercises when all we've got is verbiage from North Korea.
You know, and this raises an interesting point, Admiral, and I'd like to run it by you as a guy who's done a lot of strategic thinking and planning in the Navy and in various joint positions as well inside the Pentagon. You know, back when we were endlessly hectored, indeed it became the policy of the U.S. government under Barack Obama that we wanted to rid the world of nuclear weapons. The concern I've always had is, wait, the last thing we want to do is make the world safe for conventional war. And what you just described with these thousands of artillery pieces is the North Koreans have the capacity to destroy Seoul without nuclear weapons. And our ability to deter that kind of thing with them or the possible use of them is a key piece of deterrence, is it not? So I take your point that it really does need to be part of the equation here, that the dismantling of the threat, conventional threat, as well as the nuclear threat of North Korea, has to be front and center. Admiral, quickly, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about something I touched on with Kevin Freeman as well, just to get your professional sense of it. A Navy contractor apparently was targeted by Chinese hackers for anti-ship plans and technologies that the Navy has been developing, including a hypersonic anti-ship missile that could be launched from submarines. Your reaction to this latest evidence of successful Chinese penetration and espionage against our systems and capabilities?
Well, and to say it's shocking would be an understatement. What disturbs me more than the fact that the Chinese were successfully hacking us, which we know they try to do, they have a whole bureau set up to do this, is that nobody on the American side, in our counterintelligence side, is not held accountable. Heads need to roll. This is, school is out. This is weakening our national security and giving China untold advantages here, and it has to be, people must pay a price.
Admiral Lyons, this is the kind of fire in the belly that we've appreciated. As John Layman said, you brought it to bear magnificently in a decisive phase of the Cold War, and we wish that you were still deployed at sea, bringing it to bear today. But we value tremendously the service that you rendered to our country through your work with us at the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. God bless you, Admiral. Keep up the good work, my friend. Next up, Dr. Paul Prentice joins us right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we're welcoming for the first time to these microphones a man I had the privilege of having dinner with on Saturday night at the Western Conservative Summit. His name is Dr. Paul Prentice. He's an economist by training, indeed a PhD from the University of Connecticut in agricultural economics. He served as the chief macroeconomist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture under my old boss, President Ronald Reagan. These days, he is a senior fellow at the Independence Institute's Fiscal Policy Center, a fellow at the Centennial Institute, one of the hosts of the Western Conservative Summit, an associate scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and a professor of economics and business at Colorado Technical University, an extraordinary pedigree, and a man who is able to bring to bear all of that free market intellect and experience to make some very important points about what Donald Trump is doing with his, what he's called terrific tariffs, as well as more generally in fighting against the globalist trend. Paul Prentice, it's very good to have you back. And thank you very much for taking the time to visit with us a little bit in the aftermath of, what was in part an exposition by President Trump about the importance of getting fair trade in the course of his remarks this morning, our time, following the summit yesterday with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure, and I really enjoyed meeting you at the Western Conservative Summit and look forward to this interview.
Good. Well, let's start perhaps with something we touched on when we were together, Paul, and that is something clearly on the president's mind as well, and that is China and the role that it has long been playing. It's not unique in this regard, but it is a particularly egregious example, as you know so well, of unfair trade conducted in the guise of free trade. Talk us through how China has exploited this practice and whether what Donald Trump is trying to do is likely to correct it.
Yeah, certainly. First of all, I need to put a disclaimer. I'm speaking to you as an individual here and not on behalf of any of those institutes or universities. So these are kind of my ideas, and they're a bit out of the mainstream with respect to my fellow free marketeers. China is getting very, very strong economically, primarily because of trade deals that we have done with them to strengthen them at the same time as weakened us to the point of losing so much of our manufacturing base where they have it now. And that would be part of a normal trading system if it was all based on comparative advantage and those kind of free market ideas. But it's really been a manipulated trade deal and a very bad deal for the U.S.
Kind of mercantilist approach rather than a free market capitalist one.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, more than mercantilist, perhaps even a state-driven mercantilism, which is very close to a fascist or socialist type economy. So I don't know how long they can maintain their strength, but they're certainly on a path to become a global hegemonic power.
Is it in part dependent on their ability to tap into and essentially dominate in a sort of colonial style markets and resources through presumably this Belt and Road initiative of theirs that might enable this system to be propped up for quite a bit longer.
Yes, and think of how long they've been at this and how they play the long game compared to, say, the Western society, in particular America. But they play the long game. You may recall when they took over the Panama Canal under Jimmy Carter. They've been looking to commandeer the world's resources, control the world's shipping lanes, eventually dominate the world economy, and we've played a willing role in letting them do that.
Primarily, as I see it, for the very reason that you mentioned, and I assume a number of your colleagues actually are okay with, which is that, well, it's all one big global economy, and as long as everybody's allowing the free flow of materials and services and so on, all will be well. And yet, you have taken a very, I would say, forthright position in opposition, as has Donald Trump, to this sort of globalist approach. Walk us through that, if you would, Dr. Prentice.
Yeah, sure. Just let's go back just a little bit and realize that we allow cars manufactured in China to enter our markets at something around a 5% tariff rate. They charge cars made in America 25% tariff to come into China. So is that really free trade? Does that make sense? And so that's what President Trump is talking about, is it's just kind of normalizing.
What is the effect of that disparity for the lay person?
Sure. Here's the number one effect. Buick, out of General Motors, went and built a new manufacturing plant in China to serve the Chinese market instead of producing them in Detroit and shipping them over there. That's what that did.
And are they now exporting some of these cars to the United States to take advantage of the preferential terms?
Yes, they are. But it's primarily that we're blocked from shipping cars from Detroit to them more so. But the point is, it was just not what we would call a good trade deal, which brings up your comment that what does globalization really mean? Does globalization mean sort of the Adam Smith or David Ricardo ideal of open and free trade and among sovereign, peaceful nation states? That's the ideal of globalization. And if that was what was happening, it would be great for everybody with totally a win-win situation. But there's really two other things that are actually happening, not that ideal. And these we have to be careful of. And this is what you've been doing, tracking with your policy center. The sort of geopolitical strategy of what's happening here. So the second level is not that pure ideal globalization. It's a managed trade system with crony deals between this company and this government and then that company and that government. And it's all been very managed in these negotiations. And you have something like the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Just because it says free trade, Frank, doesn't mean it is. You know, Affordable Care Act was not affordable. If it really was free trade, it would be 12 words. You know, there will be free trade among the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Instead of those 12 words, it's 1,200 pages plus of enabling rulemaking, legislation. So it's not free trade.
Yeah. And the third major point?
The third point is that the globalization with that managed trade inside there is heading towards something that you and I and your listeners ought to be very, very concerned with, which is really it's a movement towards one world economy run by one world government, run by one world central bank. And that is just as dangerous to liberty, to freedom, to the American ideal, to national sovereignty as you could ever imagine. And that's what really we're fighting against with this idea of what globalization has become. And people think we're against the ideal of globalization, but we're just against the practice of it.
Well, the idea leaves a bit to be desired, too, but the practice of it is really horrifying. There's so much that you've said there that I'd like to drill down on, Paul. Let me just pick one point. You talked about NAFTA a moment ago. With the president out in Singapore over the past 24 hours and his presentation in the freewheeling press conference today, the backdrop, in part at least, to all of this was his decision very early in his administration, I assume at the encouragement of our friend Dr. Peter Navarro, the head of his trade council, to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And there was much gnashing of teeth about this and complaints that this was simply going to, you know, create new openings for China, and that essentially we were ceding ground and inviting our allies in Asia to sort of essentially make a separate peace with China. I'd be interested in your take on it, especially in regard to the two things that you just talked about. One, the managed trade piece of that. It seemed as though it was chock-a-block with sweetheart deals for all kinds of special interests. And again, not an instrument for free trade. And secondly, that it was very much a catalyst towards one-world arrangements, government perhaps, certainly economic, and the sovereignty of the United States would have been adversely affected had it stood. Talk us through that, if you would.
I agree. That's what was happening. So it sounded like a free trade deal. It sounded like something that would create wealth for the world. And in fact, what it was a gradual erosion of the United States sovereignty in our own economic sphere. There was even some things in there. If you look at some of the preliminary writings about it, and frankly, Frank, nobody could really even read what it was because it was over 2,000 pages and still growing. No, we don't even know what it might have fully become. But part of that was going to be some United Nations control over our Second Amendment rights with respect to our gun production. I mean, think about that. There were so many things hidden in that were anti-American, but it was disguised as this free trade agreement, and so that's sort of like a dog whistle to free market economists that if you're interfering with free trade, it's a bad thing. But you have to think strategically. You have to think like you think, you know, like your center works on these sort of geostrategic issues more so than just the economics.
Well, listen, it's so heartening as someone who, as I think I mentioned to you Saturday night when we had dinner, escaped with his life from several courses at both the undergraduate and graduate level on economics, to find an economist who's thinking geostrategically. I think Peter Navarro is one of them, and you certainly are another. And Paul, how can people find out more about the work that you do? Because I imagine that you have a lot of interesting internal discussions in the various organizations with which you're associated. But I'd like to make sure that they have the benefit of your analysis of these terrific Trump tariffs and the economic nationalism that we need to be pursuing now.
Sure. I have a link to most of my work at my page on the Independence Institute website. So that's i2i.org. And then you click on, I think it's Our People or something, and you find me listed there as a senior fellow. And then it's all my materials linked there. And keep in mind, this is my material. They've been kind enough to host it for me. We are in disagreement with the issues on trade.
Paul Prentice, thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for your service in the Reagan administration as the chief macroeconomist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the work you're doing these days at the Independence Institute. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, sir.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by a friend and colleague of many years. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He was, for many of those years, one of the senior officials in the U.S. Department of Defense with responsibility for knowing what the devil is going on in the Middle East. He worked in the storied Office of Net Assessment for many years. He was really the duty expert on Turkey and a great source of information on Iran and much else about the region. He is the author of The Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On, published by the Center for Security Policy. He's also one of the contributing authors of Ally No More, Erdogan's New Turkish Caliphate, and the rising jihadist threat to the West. Harold Rode, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
It's nice to be here, Frank. Always nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. Listen, speaking of Turkey, Harold, I did want to sort of take stock with you. There was recently, though it's been much overshadowed by other developments, including those we've been talking about in the course of the program on the North Korean front, that the United States has come to some kind of understanding with the Turks concerning their respective operations in Syria. Has this changed materially the question of whether the Turks are in fact no longer an ally? Do we now have a way forward that is much more conducive to a cooperative and actually synergistic relationship, or not?
Absolutely not. The bottom line here is we have to think, what's our strategy here? Our strategy, we must defeat radical Islamic fundamentalism, the Sunni version, there are a bunch of them, but Erdogan really is the symbol. He is the center of so much of radical Islamic Sunni terrorism. And we may have a tactical reason to work with him on things, but our long-term interests are completely different. Erdogan hasn't changed. In fact, if you listen to the way he's talking lately, he's just getting worse. He's anti-Western. He hates America. He hates a lot of American allies. And he wants to, as we wrote in our book, The Ally No More, he wants basically Turkey to be the center of the Islamic world, and that means eventually conquering the entire world.
Yeah. Harold Rhodes, so what do we make of the deal with Syria, with respect to Syria? Was that actually something that probably emboldened Erdogan rather than ended the possible friction between our two teams?
It won't end anything. It is a temporary alliance. There were times when you and I were back at the Pentagon that the KGB and the CIA worked on a project or two together. But that doesn't mean that we ended our animosity. The USSR was our enemy, and we knew it. And Erdogan is the enemy of the United States. And I am absolutely sure that a lot of the senior people in our government today know it.
Yeah. Harold, let me ask you about something else you mentioned there. The threats that the Turkish regime is increasingly expressing towards Israel, for example, as well as to another NATO ally, arguably a more reliable one these days, as well as to Cyprus, some of which have to do with the literal waters of the Eastern Mediterranean, on which the Turks apparently have now some covetous eye. Talk about what's going on in terms of access to the resources of those waters and also the threat being posed to these states.
Well, Erdogan has told the Israelis, he calls them, he compares them to Hitler, or he compares them to all sorts of things like that. He should talk what his people have done to non-Muslims, to Alevis in his own country, to Christians, and even Jews in his own country is disgusting. It's despicable. One of the people that you interview from time to time, Uzay Bulut, has written extensively on that, and she's right. Who is Turkey to tell our allies, us, how to be nice to other people, how to be compassionate? Erdogan himself, the way he slaughters his own enemies, the way he jails his enemies, he puts journalists in jail because they disagree with him. He basically owns the entire media. But I want to tell you, he's making some mistakes in Turkey, and there are Turks that realize his rallies are very poorly attended. Now, we'll see. We'll see what happens in the long run. But there are some signs that there's cracks in the dam, and we should be encouraging those people who want to return Turkey to the Atatürk path, the democratic, secular-oriented path, when Turkey was really a great ally of the United States in the past.
Strategically critical ally, for that matter, I think. Harold, speaking of Turkey, it has responded very badly to something, and I wanted to get your sense of it. In France this week, a group of something on the order of 250 prominent intellectuals and artists and other public figures, including former President Nicolas Sarkozy, no less, have issued a manifesto against new anti-Semitism in France, which has called, among other things, for changes in the Quran to take out verses calling for the killing and punishment of Jews, Christians, and Muslim non-believers. Is there any chance that it might happen, A? And B, talk a little bit about the response by Erdogan to this call.
Well, the Quran is the Quran. What is written in it is Quran is written in it. Muslims believe it is the word of Allah. And the question is, are there passages in the Quran that we can that can be reinterpreted in ways of getting along with non-Muslims? And the answer is yes, there are. Those verses, when Muhammad was weak, he supposedly was revealed, or Allah revealed to him verses that, you know, I have my religion, you have yours, let's get along. When he was stronger, when he basically was my way or the highway, or as the late Bernard Lewis would say, I'm right, you're wrong, go to hell. And there are ways of reinterpreting, and there are Muslims that can do it. We can't, as non-Muslims, we can't tell Muslims to nullify words that they believe is from Allah, that are, you know, that Allah gave them. But we can ask them to reinterpret verses, and that is a possibility. And frankly, if Islam doesn't do this, Islam is doomed. It's the process of Sharia, which said that the later verses abrogate the earlier verses. That's true. But the answer is the later verses were, it was men, it was humans, not Allah, who said that the later verses abrogate the earlier verses. Clearly, from a Muslim point of view, Allah put those earlier verses in because he had a reason for it. Now, is the reason because that Allah knew that there would come a time that Muslims would need to find a way to get along with the rest of the world? And the answer is, a lot of these, I would say, really daring Muslim scholars have said, yes, that's the reason Allah put them there. Allah isn't stupid, God forbid. And he put them because he wanted us Muslims to use them to find a way to get along. It is doable, Frank.
Well, I pray you're right, and that they will emerge dominant in this internal fight. You're absolutely right. It has to take place within Islam. My understanding of it, Harold, is that there is a Quranic passage that has been sort of the basis upon which this Sharia interpretation has been derived. You're absolutely right, by men, let's be honest. And that is that something to the effect that, God or Allah told Muhammad, I will give you something better when you're ready for it, so that the later things were deemed to replace the former. But there is a moment here when we certainly need to see this kind of reform, and it can't happen at the hands of French intellectuals, I'm afraid.
But when Erdogan, which is really the subject of our conversation, when Erdogan hears this, he goes ballistic because he doesn't want it reinterpreted. He wants to run the world.
Right, according to Sharia, unfortunately. Harold, thank you so much. I haven't had a chance to say personally to you my regret at the passing of a dear friend and mentor of yours, who you mentioned a moment ago, Bernard Lewis. It was a sad day, I think, for all of us who followed his career over very many years. And I know how fond he was of you, and we appreciate you being on as kind of his living legacy. From time to time, we look forward to visiting with you again very soon. We'll have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. On Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.